Hello, everyone, and welcome to Queens of the Bees, your favorite queer movie and TV podcast, and ours too. I'm your ever ebullient Piscean host, TJ, and I'm joined as always by...
I'm Aaron.
Who is a...
Professor.
Human being, bon vivant, funner, like, also an Aries. We are, one of us at least, is an astrology gay, like all decent folk. But anyway, I digress. So, what are we talking about this week?
Instead of answering that question, I'll just say I care for you.
I care for you a lot.
No, wait. That's almost the title of the movie. We're going to be discussing the movie I Care a Lot.
That is correct. And in case you didn't know, and if you don't know, shame on you. This was what we just did. The little bit that we did was an allusion or an homage, if you will, to a Golden Girls episode. Girls Just Want to Have Fun Before They Die, which guest stars Cesar Romero. If you want to hear more about that, we also have another podcast, The OK Petunias. But now that we have all that out of the way, what the hell is this movie about?
What is it about, really? It's about a woman who runs this ridiculous scheme of defrauding folks by taking over as the attorney who gets power of attorney over usually older folks as, you know, they start to develop questions about their ability to care for themselves. Is there someone who can step in and, you know, take care of their interest? Which is a real thing in real life. That's actually a thing that happens in real life. But in this movie, that's taken as a way to defraud folks out of their money and enrich the hero of the movie.
Or perhaps anti-hero. Or even straight-up villain. That's the question we're going to really sort of... I think that will motivate most of our discussion. So the villain in question is Marla Grayson, who is played by, of course, the divine Rosamund Pike. And I'll get into Rosamund Pike's sort of star text in a little bit, but I think that she is quite simply perfectly cast in this role. If you have seen Rosamund Pike, she's been in a lot of things. Gone Girl is probably her other major role, as in addition to the Amazon Prime series The Wheel of Time, which I am a devoted fan of. Aaron is not, because he's not a fantasy person, but...
Yeah, sorry, I mean, folks.
You know, he is a great person, but deeply flawed in some important ways, and that's one of them.
I just hope you'll accept me anyway.
I don't, but that's... so anyway, so, you know, she plays this character who has a sort of icy, fierce, steely determination to basically fleece these old people of their money. And, you know, the opening scene is basically... plays over her voiceover where she's proclaiming that she's essentially just playing by the rules that have already been established by basically those in power. And then she has this new target played by Diane Wiest, who, along with her partner slash girlfriend, she decides to defraud this person. Unbeknownst to her...
And that's where the movie goes completely off the rails.
It does go completely off the rails. But we'll talk about that, because I think there's something very Fincher-like about the way it goes off the rails. And that turns out that Diane Wiest's character is, in fact, the daughter of a mobster, played by Peter Dinklage, also famous for
mother of.
Peter Dinklage, who, of course, is very famous for being in Game of Thrones, another fantasy series that Aaron has not watched.
I've heard of it.
Well,
I understand that it was relatively popular.
That is accurate.
There's something about a winter at a wedding that...
You know, you're actually getting... You're hitting some of the important notes, so I'm actually impressed that you know that much about it. So, of course, you know, being a mobster, he's not really content to let his mother be kidnapped and, you know, wrongfully imprisoned in an old age home. So he basically tries to brutalize Marla into releasing him. And there's a whole bunch of stuff we'll get to, because, you know, down the pike in our discussion, when we get into the twists and turns of this plot, we can talk about that in more detail.
But did you say down the pike deliberately?
I did not. I wish I could claim that I made that that pun on purpose, but it was just, you know, Freudian unconscious, perhaps. You know, I meant to say it. Anyway, so the long story short, at the end, Marla is shot by the son of one of the people that she put away at the very beginning of the film, after having sort of built an entire empire, because she's joined up in an unlikely alliance with the mobster to basically, like, fleece millions more people of their wealth.
Exactly. Now, why are we talking about this movie on our queer movie podcast?
Well, at first, I decided to do it because I noticed that Marla was gay, and so I was like, well, you know, we're always looking for, you know, interesting characters. Plus, we don't do a lot of lesbian movies on this podcast, which is an oversight on our part. So I thought, well, I love Rosamund Pike, and I'll look for an excuse to talk about her, so that's why we chose it. But as it turned out, it also dovetails nicely with a sort of ongoing project of mine, where I'm looking at queer villains. You know, we talked a few weeks ago about Rope and what queer villainy looks like and what are the pleasures of queer villainy. So it all sort of like fed together. And, you know, not to say that I'm brilliant in my choice of movies, but I'm kind of brilliant in my choice of movies.
You are, in fact, brilliant.
In general, yes. Mm-hmm. So those were some of the reasons that I chose it. Because I think that Marla is a very fascinating character, both as a sort of queer character, diegetically speaking, and then that she has, a girlfriend, but also just in terms of being evil. Like, and I think that we can sort of unpack what it means to be queerly evil.
And so let's talk about her relationship with her girlfriend, because we do get a few scenes throughout this that sort of show that bond as being sort of the only kind of relationship that that Marla seems to have. Her life is sort of dedicated to the scam that she runs, except for this personal connection to Fran.
Right.
So let's talk about that first so that we can then get to the rest of the movie.
Right. So I will say that there's a lot of physical, like, impalpable screen chemistry between Rosamund Pike and Aza Gonzalez, who plays Fran. Like, it's not... Part of it is, when they have their makeout scenes, which are sort of the explicit moments when we get into what makes them queer. But it's also, when they're engaging in a grift with each other, they share a series of looks, and there's a sort of sense that these are two people who truly understand each other.
Mm-hmm.
It reminds me... a sort of an inverted or twisted version of the characters from I Love You, Philip Morris.
Mm-hmm, yes.
Although Fran is much more of a willing participant than Ewan McGregor's character is in this whole situation.
Definitely.
But I was reminded of this, and I think this film is less funny than I Love You, Philip Morris, but it reminds me a lot of that. Because we have a queer grifter who is kind of not obeying the rules. This is a much more, like... Let me put it this way. If David Fincher had directed I Love You, Philip Morris, I think this would be the result.
Yes, yes, it would be a lot more like this. And the other reason I wanted to talk about Marla's relationship with Fran is because it's one of the few things, at least for me, that sort of humanizes her, separate from just simply the pursuit of wealth at all cost and the willingness to sort of to completely exploit people in all kinds of ways, usually by preying on their actual vulnerabilities, conditions that actually make it so that they're less able to stand up for themselves when the scamster comes into their lives, because they are sort of in a position of decline, and maybe do need somebody like maybe family stepping in to help with them, or maybe an actual guardian to come in, but instead they get Marla, who just takes advantage of them. It's so nice to have this other side that we see of her. Otherwise, she would just be sort of an almost robotic type villain.
Yes.
It's like she's actually a person, and we get to see that in those moments with Fran.
Right. I mean, I'm thinking in particular of, say, the moment after, after Dinklage's character, who I need to look up the name, whose name is Roman Lunyov, basically kidnaps Marla. Pulls out her, like, she punches, she gets punched in the face, loses a tooth, gets dumped in a lake in a car, and manages to escape. While all of that's happening, Fran is basically, like, knocked out and left to die in a house that's being filled up with gas. But Marla goes back to save her.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's a moment of actual, maybe not selflessness, but putting herself on the line, putting her neck out for someone else, which we don't see her do at any other point in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say that the only other sort of remarkable emotional connection she seems to have is with her doctor accomplice, who is killed also by the gangsters. She seems to be genuinely, like, angry about that.
Yeah.
And, like, affected personally and emotionally in a way that we don't necessarily see in many other aspects of her life.
Mm-hmm. True, true. Although there, I wonder, is that just because the death of that doctor means sort of a loss of a contact that facilitates the scam.
I mean, I think even for a cynical film, that I'm not sure it's quite that cynical.
Yeah.
If anything, I think that it may be that she feels like it's been an affront to her own power, like her own sense of agency that she does not approve of, and will go to any lengths to avoid and to challenge.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
And I think that one of the brilliant things about Pike's performance is that she doesn't... I wouldn't say that she makes us sympathize with Marla by any stretch of the imagination.
Certainly not.
Because, like... what Marla is doing is unequivocally, like, reprehensible and evil. Like, she's literally defrauding and imprisoning old people against their will. But I do think that what makes Pike's performance so, like, captivating to watch, is that, you know, she almost makes us, like, cheer her on. I don't know how, I was trying to figure out how I felt about it. Like, am I cheering this character on? Am I sort of taking pleasure in her ruthlessness? Like, what are we, not necessarily what the film intends us to feel, but, like, what are the many ways in which we can engage with this character?
Yeah.
How did you feel?
Oh, I was definitely cheering her on because I love cynicism. I love dark movies. I love people doing bad things and, frankly, getting away with it. I love right. that in movies. Not so much in real life, but in movies where it's safe. I like that kind of story because it's such an interesting subversion of the traditional narratives that we've all sort of grown up with, where in some way or another, justice kind of has to be served. Mm. Order has to be restored. I like it when that doesn't happen, or at the very least, you make it look like it won't happen really up close till the end. I like it when you play with that expectation.
Right, and I mean, you know, we talk a lot on this pod, and I, as a film viewer, I tend to put a lot of stock in, like, stars and their power to exert a sort of charisma.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Pike is one of those people, because what makes her so extraordinary as a performer is that she excels at playing these really icy
exactly.
characters.
I was just about to call her an ice queen.
She is. When I think of the term ice queen, this is what I think of. And she plays this role similarly in, like, Gone Girl. She's also very similar in The Wheel of Time, where she plays Maureen Sedai, who's a very sort of, like, cunning and sometimes ruthless figure who manipulates others for what she believes to be the greater good.
Mm-hmm.
And we see shades of that here too, not for the greater good part, but, you know, her skill at manipulation is unrivaled. And I think that's part of what gives her a queer bite. Like, I'm thinking of all of the scenes in the courtroom where she's manipulating others and
mm-hmm.
even manipulating the judge, who seems like a willing dupe, quite
yes.
frankly.
Yes.
But, you know, there's a way that Marla, or that Pike as Marla, performs as, you know, this sort of well-meaning do-gooder who's really just looking out for their own best interests.
Exactly.
And you almost find yourself believing her, even if, as you know, even before these first courtroom scenes, we know that she's a ruthless monster because she's told us that.
Yeah, exactly. And for me, I felt that those scenes were so interesting because of, she was, for me, dancing right on the edge of revealing her nefarious plot. It's like she was almost taking pleasure in throwing it in the face of opposing counsel what she's doing. It's like, because, and partly because they do sort of take some liberties with the law. In any movie that's going to talk about law is going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the very least, they have to sort of simplify things because court proceedings are really slow and boring and nobody wants to watch all that.
Right.
But here, they really did take quite a few liberties with some of the rulings and giving her authority over people's lives for almost no justification within the world of the movie, which is why I think it was right for you to call the judge kind of a willing dupe. It's like she's got this one judge
yep.
who seems to be particularly inclined to grant her authority over these people's lives, rather than that being sort of a legally sound ruling based on the circumstances.
Mm.
And that's why, for me, it was nice to kind of watch Pike as Marla play with that. It's almost like she's getting something over
mm-hmm.
on the, not on necessarily on the judge who might be an, but on the other lawyer. It's like, it's not just I'm beating you in this case, it's like I'm getting one over on you at the same time.
Right. And I'm thinking too of that moment in the very first courtroom scene we see where she's challenging, or where she's being challenged by the son of another patient that she's getting ready to has already incarcerated, and he's, for lack of a better word, looks like a Trump voter. Like he,
yes.
and he, and I think the film uses that deliberately
mm-hmm.
because he makes a point of, like, using the word bitch, for example, and I think he may call her the C word. I don't remember exactly, but, like, he goes out of his way to be misogynist
mm-hmm.
in a way that makes us identify, or at least to affiliate ourselves with Marla,
mm-hmm.
even as she's doing the reprehensible thing. He also is not necessarily positioned as being any kind of moral person.
Yeah. And but I love that juxtaposition because I love how that ultimately plays with our expectations as a certain kind of audience, especially
mm-hmm.
for us that, you know, fancy ourselves a bit more progressive in how we see things, you know, that might be extra positioned to see ourselves as opposed to that character because of the way that we take him as a kind of MAGA type figure.
Mm-hmm.
I love that the movie lets us play with that in the face of a character who, as you already pointed out, has already been presented to us as the bad guy. We already know that she's actually a villain here, but still we like her more than that guy.
Right. And I mean, I think part of the reason we like her is that she's at least honest. Like, she's a monster, but she's honest. That's what she's doing. Mm-hmm. Like, that opening voiceover does a lot of work in sort of laying out who Marla is, what her worldview is, what her, like, ideal, her mm-hmm. philosophy is, which is basically the world is run by terrible people that make the rules that the rest of us have to follow. So I'm going to just exploit the system for my own benefit, because mm-hmm. why not everyone else does?
And it's funny that you say that it's like she's honest about it, because obviously in the world of the movie, her entire ploy rests upon the idea that she has to present herself as being this honest figure who's looking out for these folks, but obviously she isn't. So she's obviously lying within the world of the movie to everybody all the time.
Right.
But because she lets the audience in on it, she almost makes us accomplices her, because we know the secret of the scam right away, but we kind of have to follow her along as she's misleading everybody that she has to interact with.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's the film's brilliance, lies in its ability to sort of like, it's almost scalpel-like in its precision mm-hmm. and how easily it cuts away the hypocrisy of our lives and sort of forces us to confront it. Mm-hmm. I mean, because lots of people put their elderly folks away, even if they don't necessarily need to. It's just easier.
Yeah.
I mean, so Marla does it just because she wants their money, but is that any less reprehensible than people who put their old folks in a home just because they don't want to take care of them?
Yeah, but for me, it gets even more complicated than that, because the movie isn't just about sort of putting them away in a home. It's about taking power of attorney.
Ah, yes.
So that you can make all of their decisions for them and all that kind of stuff. So it's not like it's just put, you know, grandma in a home and never go visit her again. It's get all of her finances, mm-hmm. whatever that means. And the home is really just sort of a place that makes it easier to do that,
right?
So that people can be separated from the homes that they actually already own.
Mm.
Like, that's why that's so important. It's like, it's not just, you know, put Diane Weiss characters in a home because we don't trust her to take care of herself. It's no, put her in a home so that we can sell her house.
Right.
Because, again, she's in the independent part of the facility. Like, she's allowed to kind of make her own decisions, move around. She's able to do that kind of thing. It's not like she's stuck under constant supervision or anything like that. It's just get her out of the house.
Right.
So it can be sold.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I think that's part of the film's, like, sort of queer bite, is that it really just sort of lays open the hypocrisies and the ugliness of modern capitalism. Because, mm-hmm. you know, in the film's point of view, and I think from Marla's point of view, people aren't people. They're just data points, or they're just dollar signs.
Yep.
They're pieces on a game board to be moved around. And that's pretty much how capitalism views people. Mm-hmm. It's how capitalism views everything,
yep.
whether it's content or anything else. And, you know, say what you will about Marla, at least she acknowledges that and doesn't dress it up in other sort of fancy ways that capitalism usually does.
Exactly. Like, she doesn't try to defend, like, to the audience.
Right.
Anything that she's doing. She's like, yep, this is my game.
Yep. I mean, she is in some ways sort of like capitalism personified, or late capitalism personified.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there's something kind of chilling about that, and I think that's part of the reason that she's such a fascinating character, is because she just sort of puts into one individual all of the guilt and all of the sort of like reprehensibleness of capitalism writ large.
Yep.
So that all, you know, thinking about that, I want to dwell for a moment on the end, because as I alluded to already, she does, like, die at the end. Mm-hmm. So, you know, she actually makes peace with the mobster. They decide to sort of expand her business into this, mm-hmm. you know, giant conglomerate, old person agency kind of thing. Yeah. It's very unclear. It's conveyed in a montage, so it doesn't have to, like, sustain any kind of...
Exactly, but the story gets so weird that I feel like it's actually worth discussing here, rather than glossing over it like we do sometimes with plot points that aren't all that interesting
right.
to our points about queerness. I think it's worth it to talk about this, because we've skipped over the weird complication of the fact that Marla has decided to scam this particular woman.
Right.
And it's like, you know, she's gotten away with this scam many, many times with lots of other old people. But she picked the wrong person this time, and that's what causes all of the complications, because Diane Weiss' character isn't just some sort of sweet, slightly doddering older lady. As we said, she herself is involved in organized crime, but as the mother of an actual, you know, high-level gangster, she herself is high-level in this. And we figure all of this out with Marla when she goes and gets control of this safe deposit box.
Right.
And discovers not just, you know, money, documents, things like that, but a bunch of stolen diamonds,
which is how this turns into a weird sort of caper movie in some ways, where there's the what, where did the movie, the diamonds come from, what's going to happen with them, all that stuff. They, at some point, we lose sight track of them. It goes off the rails in a delightful way.
So are you saying the ridiculousness of the plot is itself queer?
I would say kinda, yeah. But it goes off the rails in these ways that make the rest of the story, I think, much more interesting than they would be if this were just a sort of preying on hapless victims type story. That would make it more like an episode of Law & Order SVU.
Right.
Like, having this twist makes it, for me, a real movie, because there's something interesting that has to happen after we've established the basic premise. Because once we've done that, we've now, like, wait a minute, you thought you picked a helpless old person, but you've got somebody who's actually probably tougher and more hard-edged than you are, Marla, by running up against this particular woman.
Right, and so, I mean, Diane Weiss gives a really great performance as Jennifer Peterson, like this old lady who has a sort of icy, much like Marla, sometimes has an icy demeanor. Like, you know, their moments of confrontation are exquisitely crafted. Like, mm-hmm. It's really fun to watch these two spar against each other. And those are sort of islands of calm amidst the utter insanity that sort of takes the narrative in all sorts of very strange directions, you know, especially once Roman, like, kidnaps Marla. And then, not content with having kidnapped her, then basically puts her in a car, which is then dumped in a lake. She somehow, comes to consciousness, kicks her way out, and then goes to a thrift, or not a thrift stop, but a gas station, where she, you know, loses a tooth, but puts it in a thing of milk. Mm-hmm. It's impossible to convey just how insane all of this is.
Yeah, should we figure she's a Terminator type character?
She is.
It's like she kind of keeps going.
I mean,
keeps fighting.
I mean, and I think there's something. I mean, some critics, when I was reading through the reviews, sort of took the movie to task for making her sort of this girl boss that can survive anything.
Mm-hmm.
But I find that kind of liberating.
Yeah,
I think that's kind of fun because, you know, men get to do that in movies all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I'm looking at you, like Bruce Willis, or as you say, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Like, these people deserve, like, survive all kinds of implausible explosions and shit. Why shouldn't this badass lesbian get to do it?
And she manages to do it while managing to not ever have a hair out of place.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, of course, she then orchestrates the kidnapping of Roman, and they basically almost beat him to death and leave him to be discovered. And then he wakes up getting ready to see Marla having also obtained his power of attorney.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting turnabout in, you know, her assertion of her own agency and power, even against this sort of, like, you know, patriarchal figure.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, credit to Peter Dinklage, too, I think, who gives a very compelling performance as Roman.
Yeah, exactly. Now, there's that one moment that you point out where she's mad as she gets sort of power of attorney over him. That's where the movie gets the most ridiculous.
Yes.
It's already hard enough for me to accept the idea that this scam has worked for her as consistently as it has up to this point, that there seems to almost never be anybody intervening in any way, shape, or form, or anybody even noticing the pattern with which she seems to go after her victims. Okay, fine. Nobody picks up on that.
Right, especially given that one of the earliest scenes, we see how many photos are up on her wall of all of her, like, victims. It's this hasn't raised a red flag with anybody?
Exactly. No one's figured that out bad enough, but okay, I can accept that. Where it strained credulity for me at this point in the movie, even after accepting all of the other weirdness, that she would also that readily and quickly gain power over him. And it's so ridiculous that the movie even glosses over it. It happens off screen, and we're just sort of told about it. Because I don't think they could have pulled off a convincing hearing in front of a judge where a judge would have made that ruling. I don't think they could have made that work.
Yeah.
Because there's absolutely no reason for someone who's simply injured to lose power of attorney over themselves.
Unless he was in a coma for like 6 months or
exactly.
something. Which we've given no reason to assume.
And even then, he's a part of a criminal organization. Someone would show up as a, quote, relative.
Right.
To take care of
him. I mean,
we
already know he has a high-powered lawyer, played by, what's his name?
Exactly, and that person would also be the natural person to take over in the event that he actually was incapacitated. The fact that he already has a lawyer would make that person.
I mean, Chris Messina, who plays the lawyer, is quite well cast, you know, and there's another fun sparring scene between the two of them. But I don't think, you know, even he's not going to just stand by and let Marla take custody of, you know, Roman.
She would have absolutely no standing. He's already got legal representation.
Right.
Like, there's no reason for her to do that. She would have to prove that he was not being well served, whatever, and there's no reason to suggest anything.
Yeah.
Like I said, that's the part of the movie that even with accepting all the other weirdness, that was hard to accept for
me. I mean, but again, I think that's, you know, when I was thinking about how I would, if I was reviewing this film, say in a film review, I would argue, or I would say that, you know, Pike's performance and the sort of glossy production kind of help smooth it over, mm-hmm. so that you don't necessarily have to pay that much attention to these little details that otherwise don't make a whole lot of sense. You know, and of course it doesn't make a lot of sense either that Roman's like, you know, I want to give you $10 million to start this whole thing when he's been fighting with her about like how much the diamonds are worth. Like it's, mm-hmm. there's some little plot points that don't always add up, but I don't really care.
And even for that, it's like once I was willing to accept the basic premise that forced them into this sort of weird alliance, and I'm like, okay, fine, from there, I can accept it, even though it is strange why they would ever strike up this deal, why for that amount of money, any of that. But if at that point, if I could accept the idea that she's managed to wrest this sort of legal control over him, but at the same time, he remains in a position where he could have her killed.
Right.
It makes sense that there's... In that way, if you accept the sort of mutually assured destruction nature
yeah.
of that situation, then it can work. I just have a hard time fully accepting those premises.
Right. So, I mean, that leads us then into, like, you know, at the top I was saying about the montage where we get this, you know, revelation that now Marla is this high-powered figure. She gets interviewed on, like, MSNBC and shit. Like, she's on the cover of Fortune. I don't know, all these things as she kind of ascends the heights of financial success that she's yearned for so long. Which, of course, is utterly ridiculous and implausible, but yet somehow the film's conviction sells it.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, Pike's performance, yeah, like, we see her getting interviewed. And then, of course, right as she's at the apex of her achievements, the guy from the beginning shoots her, which, I mean, it's kind of like Chekhov's redneck. Like, we know that, you know, we know that he's going to come back and kill her in the end. Like,
he looks like a guy that's going to pull out a gun at some point.
Yes. He looks like the kind of guy who would shoot a woman who made him angry.
Yeah, but to be fair to that guy, and this is what I love about the movie, even though we just talked about how sometimes the movie gets a little bit broad in how it represents certain things, brought to the point of ridiculousness. This is something that I thought was actually very nicely nuanced about the movie, is that since he does have that sort of MAGA-type persona that a lot of folks immediately are going to want to reject, I love that he comes back and shoots this criminal in defense of his mother.
Right.
Which is, like, the most natural thing for a person in that situation to want to do.
Mm.
But because it's him, it's like we still want to argue about why it makes him bad.
Right.
When he's doing, again, I think the most natural reaction that a character would have in that situation. I think that any of us might respond in that way.
Right, because as is revealed, like, his mother died while in a home and he couldn't see her because we've already seen that he, like, caused the whole scene and wasn't allowed to, like, visit her anymore. So, you know, it's a little interesting moment of moral ambiguity. It's not really moral ambiguity when you get down to it.
That's what I was like, because it's not even ambiguous. That's why I love it so much.
Right. But it feels ambiguous, even if it's not actually, when you get down to it, ambiguous.
Exactly. And that's what I love about a movie like this, when it can sort of force you to confront your own ideas and how... What I love about how this, I think this is a good sort of like example of what one might call like a kind of neo-queer type movie that plays around with expectations like this, where the queer character is the one that is pretty much just irredeemable, and it's the sort of MAGA type figure that actually deserves a bit of sympathy.
Right. I mean, how would any of us respond if our, you know, parental figure were put away against her own will and we weren't allowed to see her by this, you know, woman that we don't even know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the larger question I think that this ending sequence asks is, you know, is it an example of the barrier gaze trope, which, you know, as I was reading through the reviews, a lot of people brought that up. It's a very divisive ending in that regard. But even if it is, I'm, as I get older, don't always think the barrier gaze is bad per se.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it can be used in bad ways, but I think that this is something more sophisticated than just barrier gaze.
Yeah, I think that the problem with the barrier gaze, or the idea of that trope, or talking about that trope, I think it's fine to point that out, but I think the mistake that a lot of people make is they think that tropes are sort of all-encompassing.
Mm-hmm.
And that because this is a gay character who dies at the end, that is barrier gaze, and because tropes are bad, that is bad. As right. opposed to seeing that, yeah, it's a gay character who died, but it's also a gay character who was a stone-cold criminal.
all the way through the movie.
Right.
And whose ruthless actions led to the deaths of several people.
Right, and whose, you know, whose own death is in some ways the end result of her own action.
Exactly.
Like, it's not as if she's innocent. And I'm like, if I was sort of hypothesizing what I would feel if Marla was allowed to sort of ride off into the sunset with Fran, I don't know that I would feel as satisfied.
Exactly.
Like, it would be a different kind of satisfaction. Mm-hmm. But there's something, I think that part of why the ending is effective is it is troubling, and that it's okay for films to be troubling.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that actually can be a positive thing.
Exactly.
And that we actually lose something when films are too neatly tied up.
Exactly. And I even like it when movies do like this, where it throws a sort of morally questionable, I won't even say ambiguous, I'll just say flat out say questionable, morally questionable premise to the audience. Like you just said, what would it be like for her if she got away? That would be condoning horrific levels of fraud that don't just deprive people of their money, but deprive them of their liberty.
Right.
Because it's not just that she's stealing from folks in order to effectively steal from them. She effectively has them locked up.
Yeah. And I mean, we see the sort of mechanics, how that works. Like, we see the extent to which the doctor is implicated. We see the director of the home who's out there, all tied up in this mm-hmm. corrupt system. And that's, you know, it's okay if we see that condemned.
Yeah.
And I think that what makes that work is that Pike's interpretation of this character, she doesn't really have any interiority, like, except for, as mm-hmm. we said earlier, her relationship with Fran, but there's not really some sort of complex psychological portrait
yes.
involved here. Like, it would have been very easy for the film to give a sort of a banal, you know, trite explanation for why she was rejected by her parents or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But nope, it's just she wants money and she decided that she was going to make it however she could. And mm-hmm. in a corrupt system, why not?
Exactly. And I like that you brought that up, because I think it gets at what I think the movie does well, is that it forces you to question things, at least for me, before I realized what I was even questioning.
Right.
It's like it just brought up so many questions that I thought I was, you know, maybe thinking about this as a, well, how are we thinking about sort of this portrayal of queer villainy and all that kind of stuff? But really what I ended up focusing more on is in thinking about the movie after we watched it was, what do we think about justice? Like, how do we think when people do something that's demonstrably bad, shouldn't they be punished for it?
Right. Yeah, so I mean, I think that sometimes the barrier gaze trope can be more than just a trope, that it can be something that actually like forces us to think sort of more critically about how queer characters can inhabit the world. Like, we talk a lot on this podcast that, you know, it's okay for queer characters to be imperfect. Like, I think that there was a movement roughly from like the late 90s to, you know, a few years ago, which mm-hmm. to see queer people, to want queer people to be represented positively
mm-hmm.
and to see their stories represented in ways that were, you know, uplifting. And I do think there is a need for that kind of genre.
Mm-hmm.
But as we say so often on Queens of the Bees, like, I think there's also a need and a space for flawed queer characters, for queer yeah. villains, for people who die in the end, because they should, because they're monsters. Like,
and for me, that era that you talked about, that sort of like the focus on sort of positive queer representation, for me, I've always felt like that was just a little bit boring. And I think that it's because it just unfortunately happened to coincide at a time when in sort of more mainstream media with the push toward anti-heroes and more complicated lead figures.
Mm.
So it's sort of like queer media was sort of going in the opposite direction of the cultural zeitgeist on that point.
Right.
Where in TV and in movies, what was becoming far more popular were the good guys who weren't so good.
Right.
Or the complicated hero figures, or, you know, the main hero is a serial killer themselves, but maybe sometimes they're killing people who are even worse than they are. That more morally complicated thing is what was happening in media broadly.
Right.
At the same time that we were going, queer characters just sort of have to be perfect, which for me makes a lot of that stuff just kind of flat.
Right. I mean, because I'm glad you brought that up, because it strikes me that, you know, I Care a Lot seems to come out at, like, an interesting time. Like, the anti-hero age from roughly, what, the early 2000s to 2016, mm-hmm. give or take, you know, is the era, as you rightly alluded to, like, the Tony Sopranos, the Nurse Jackies, the mm-hmm. Dexters, the characters of Mad Men, Breaking Bad. Like, that's the sort of, and not very many women, I should point out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so it's really kind of, certainly not very many queer people. So that's what makes this film so interesting coming out as it does in 2020 to 2021. Like, a very different time when media is sort of shifting away from the anti-hero cynicism. Mm-hmm. So it feels like sort of a bit of a throwback, but I think that it's a timely one because it is, as you say, a sort of corrective toward the thrust toward queer representation that is much more positivist in its outlook.
Exactly. And of course, it's important, like you said before, I should also echo that. I think that, you know, positive representation is important. It's necessary to have that in the media landscape. But positive representation, generally speaking, doesn't lend itself to sort of nuanced storytelling.
Right.
Or feature, you know, interesting, nuanced performance like we get in this movie. It's like, it's just not set up for that.
Right. And I'm thinking here, too, of, like, our whole discussion reminds me of sort of the debate within academia between, like, LGBT studies and queer studies.
Mm-hmm.
Like, LGBT, broadly speaking, LGBT studies is more about, like, you know, finding heroic queer figures in the past that we can think about, mm-hmm. like, that we can hold up as examples. Queer studies, more or less, is about troubling all that, like, blowing apart distinctions, like,
yeah.
you know, forcing us to interrogate how it's constructed and all that. There's a sort of radical subversive edge to queerness that queer studies and sort of queer understandings of popular culture, and that's where I sort of position this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, where I find the pleasures in this film come from that sort of queer questioning of rules and norms and structures and all that sort of thing.
And that questioning of rules, structures, and norms and all that stuff in terms of queer representation. Great, I think, time to segue into another point we wanted to make sure we got to. And you were going to make a comparison of this movie to the movie Rope, which we've talked about on a previous podcast. But I think this is a great time to talk about that now, because that movie very much gets into that question of subverting norms, expectations, and all that, because it's all about criminals who simply choose to commit crime for the sake of committing crime. Kind of like in this movie here, where Marla's motivation is just money for the sake of money. Like I said, there is no, I was deprived as a child background. There was none of that was thrown in as an explanation. She just wants the money because she wants it, and she's willing to do anything to get it.
Right. I mean, that's the power of fiction. Like, you and I talk about this a lot. Like, movies like I Care a Lot have the power to sort of indulge us in our dark desires that we wouldn't admit to ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect that part of the discomfort that some queer viewers may feel with this movie is that it does sort of force us to look in the mirror in a way that we find deeply disconcerting,
mm-hmm.
and that's why we respond the way that we do.
Exactly.
Like, that's why we respond negatively to these kinds of films and to characters like Marla, who are so reprehensible, but yet also so fascinating and so compelling.
Yeah, because they force us to question the implicit notion that, sadly, a lot of us, including myself, sometimes walk around with. Or we sometimes say, you know, because of my life, because of whatever hardships, it's kind of okay for me to do whatever I feel like.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a good reminder of the fact that that's just not true.
Right.
It's like, we're not justified in doing any and everything just because of how we might feel. Like, we still kind of need to follow the rules, follow the law, because when we don't, we cause problems. We do things like Marla, where, again, she's depriving innocent people of their freedom and their possessions. That's not okay, even though she's a really cool lesbian anti-hero.
Yep. Much like Brandon and Philip, she's a deeply reprehensible character that we just can't look away from.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that feels like a good place to end. I feel like we've really dove deep into the dark psychology of I Care a Lot.
Mm-hmm.
So give us a few moments, and we'll be back. We have a couple of short segments to round us out today. So give us a few minutes, as I said, to freshen up, you know, clear our throats a bit, and we'll be right back.
More lip gloss.
Some more lip gloss and more makeup, and we'll be right back. Right, so every so often on this podcast, you know, we talk a little bit about small town queer life. Well, one of us is a native small town queer.
Guess which one?
But, you know, I'm this sort of country mouse. Aaron is the more city mouse character. So, you know, every so often we like to sort of highlight small town queerness, because I think that that's the thing that gets sometimes swept under the rug, but overlooked, shall we say. So on a recent outing, we were going to Lewis, Delaware, which is a small sort of like coastal town up in the coast of Delaware. And we stopped at this very lovely little museum, and I'm going to butcher this pronunciation because it's Dutch and I don't speak Dutch, but I believe it's pronounced Swanendael Museum, which is, you know, basically a history museum of the Lewis area. And imagine my surprise when one of the first exhibits we saw was of a local trans activist named, mm-hmm. you know, Kathy Carpenter, who had donated some objects like a dress when she was announced as I think it was Miss Gay Delaware or something. If I can't remember the exact award, and her tiara. And, you know, there was a lovely sort of write-up about her, you know, coming to terms with her gender identity, what that meant and so forth. And I mean, to give you context, Lewis has like, I don't know, a couple of thousand people, that. It's not a very big town, even though, of course, being in the sort of coastal area, it's a little bit more progressive, socially speaking. Mm-hmm. But I was just kind of struck because I didn't expect that to be in the sort of town museum.
Exactly.
I just found that very, like, it filled me with optimism, I suppose. You know, that we see so much about, you know, how hard it is to be queer in today's environment. But here we have this woman, this trans woman who, you know, came out in the late 90s, early 2000s, and has been a vibrant part of this community, is now enshrined within a local history. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just so important.
Yeah. And for me, I just want to emphasize things for folks who maybe never will get a chance to get to this place, is that this museum, it's a tiny building. It's kind of like, it's like an old house or something like that, or maybe it was a chapel or something. It looks kind of like that.
Yeah.
But it's a very small building that has a very, 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 very small first floor and an even slightly smaller upstairs. But it's a tiny venue. And when you walk right in, there's this relatively large display case that TJ is talking about that occupies quite a bit of, you know, relatively speaking, a lot of floor space, but takes up nearly your total field of vision as soon as you walk in. That, for me, is what makes it so special. It's not like just that this place has this on display, but it's so prominently featured. Mm-hmm. It's like you can't miss it. It's the first thing that catches you as soon as you walk in, and I'm just kind of like, I love the commitment to displaying this woman's artifacts in this way.
Mm-hmm.
Because they really don't have to. Like, the rest of the exhibits in the place are much older artifacts about the history of Lewis and all of that kind of stuff. This is a much more contemporary thing that they could have hidden away, or it could have just been, like, a poster on the wall or something like that, but they decided to make it a featured thing.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to just sort of referencing it in some other way.
Right. I mean, I think it's also a timely reminder for all of us who, you know, growing up in small towns can sometimes assume that it's all small-minded. And I mean, that is true. There are many parts of the country that are very small-minded. But I think there are these sort of, like, unexpected gems, these little oases of, you know, acceptance and tolerance that I think are just really important to emphasize when they come out. Because I think that if we are all striving, as I think we all are, either explicitly or implicitly, to sort of be accepted and welcomed into our communities, I think one thing we can do is to sort of, like, celebrate these moments, but also work to integrate ourselves into our local histories. Because queer people are everywhere. Mm-hmm. And they're in small towns, they're in big towns, they're in rural areas. I think that drawing attention to and sort of making a commitment to enshrining and interweaving these into local histories is just such a vital task. Mm-hmm. And it's one that goes underappreciated. Because, I mean, no one's going to write their dissertation about queer life in Lewis, Delaware. Like,
mm-hmm. And someone might, you know.
I mean, I hope they do, but I'm just saying, like, that's not the kind of thing that draws people necessarily, but it should, is what I'm getting at. Mm-hmm. Like, because I think that these lives, these tapestries of individual people are important.
Yeah, and whereas for me, I would actually guess that it's far more likely that someone would write their dissertation on sort of queer life in Lewis, Delaware. It's less likely that other people would, who are not academics and focus very specifically on those things, are ever going to find out about these things, except for institutions like this kind of throwing it in your face
right
as soon as you walk in the door. Like, without that, a lot of folks would just miss this information.
Right. So I think that's really important to sort of talk, like, to draw attention to these things, to visit them if you come by, like, because I think that this is how we sort of reach regular folk that aren't necessarily, like, plugged into queer life as much, mm-hmm, as we are.
Exactly.
So two other items of note relating to this. One is that I will actually be speaking on queer life in small towns in Appalachia in October at the University of Central Arkansas, thanks to a very good friend of mine who invited me to speak. Mm-hmm. So I would, you know, love to speak at your university or, you know, small town. If you would like me to do that, I would be happy to do so. And then relatedly, coming up the second weekend of October, so I believe it's the 6th, starting on the 6th, let me just double check the calendar. Bah! Yeah, so the 6th, 7th, and 8th in Huntington, West Virginia, the Appalachian Queer Film Festival will be taking place. If you are, you know, like me, from Appalachia, if you can get there, I definitely recommend it. We have some great films coming up. I've served on the board, full disclosure. But again, I think that those kinds of small festivals serve their own important purpose, Because a lot of people from Appalachia aren't going to go to TIFF. They're not going to go to Sundance. They're not going to go to the Out Festival.
And what's TIFF?
The Toronto International Film Festival. Or these other sort of big festivals where queer films so often play. So I think that these smaller festivals are really important for local queer communities because it reminds them of the great world of queer film that exists outside necessarily of what they might experience.
Mm-hmm. And there are also opportunities for folks in those communities who are maybe creative content producers mm-hmm. to display their work too. So it's a chance for those voices to kind of have an outlet.
Yep. So I think that, you know, if you can make it, or if you're from Appalachia, or if, you know, if you're from Huntington, I don't know if we have any Huntington listeners, but if you are, then definitely get your tickets. They're pretty affordable. It's $45, I think, for the whole weekend. So feel free to do that. And also, you, of course, can reach out to me. I'm happy to gush about that. So give us one more minute. We have just a very small, short segment on what else we're watching that's queer-related. So we'll be right back. So to wrap up for today's wonderful recording, I thought we could just talk briefly about another great lesbian movie that we both just watched, Moving On, starring mm-hmm. the divine Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin.
And one of their wonderful pairings. They've been so many. The decades.
I mean, so many are, you know, queer. Obviously, 9 to 5, I think, is widely regarded as a queer classic, mm-hmm. even though I don't think any of the characters are queer. Exactly. But that doesn't really matter. Obviously, Grace and Frankie is queer, although neither Grace nor Frankie themselves are queer, but their husbands mm-hmm. are. So in this film, it turns out that, you know, Jane Fonda plays a character who is going to a friend's funeral because she's going to murder her husband.
Yes, which is a great premise for any... You set up any movie like that, I'll watch.
Yes, and I mean, so as always, Jane Fonda is divine and she looks fantastic for her age. But, she, you know, she's joined in her efforts by an old friend played by Lily Tomlin, who is the lesbian, of course. You know, if anyone's going to play an octogenarian lesbian who wants to aid in murder, it's going to be Lily Tomlin.
That one. Literally no one else could play that part.
Yeah, so I mean, so Jane plays the character Claire. Lily Tomlin plays Evelyn. So Claire's, her friend's husband assaulted/raped her when they were young. Mm-hmm. And that's why she wants to get vengeance, because she never told him, and it basically derailed her whole life.
Exactly, and Evelyn's the only person she ever told
right.
about
and,
it.
And so, but Evelyn was also conducting an affair with the dead friend, mm-hmm. and so has her own motivation for wanting to do that, you know, or to participate in this little murder caper. And it's, I thought it was going to be like a black comedy, and there are elements of that to the film, but it's much more sort of a melodrama or woman's film with black comedy notes.
Yes.
And I think that's fine, and I think that it works in that regard. Mm-hmm. And I think that both Tomlin and Fonda are giving terrific performances that make up for whatever sort of minor shortcomings the screenplay itself might have. Mm-hmm.
And one thing that I like that this movie did really well, even though, of course, Lily Tomlin plays Evelyn, who's a much more sort of who's a very outspoken type character, I love that the movie feels realistic in showing both characters being relatively reticent to reveal these things that they've kept secret for right. so long. I think that that's very in keeping with people of that generation who, you know, came of age before the sort of confessional era that we live in now, where everybody's telling everything about themselves all the time. This is a generation of folks where you kept things to yourself. There mm-hmm. were a lot of things that you just never wanted anyone else to know, so you just never discussed it.
Yep.
Except maybe to your closest friend, if you absolutely needed to say it out loud to someone. There might be one person that you ever confide in, and that person will keep that secret forever mm-hmm. because things were just different back then. It meant so much to maintain discretion.
Yep. And I also like there's, you know, a nice moment where we see Evelyn sort of having this bond with a young queer kid. Like, he's I use that term because it's clear that he has some, you know, he wants to wear her earrings and her jewelry and play dress up. So it's, you know, is he queer? Is he trans? Like, is he non-binary? Like, we don't know, and it doesn't matter mm-hmm. ultimately.
Yeah, it's a young kid.
Right. And but she has sort of an outlet. And that's, the story doesn't necessarily go anywhere. But I just thought that was a nice moment that she has with this kid.
Exactly. I thought it was the perfect amount to kind of show the characters as being sort of connected to sort of current day understandings of gender identity mm-hmm. and all that kind of stuff. Because on this point, Evelyn's more progressive than pretty much anybody else
right.
in the movie, of course, despite being in her 80s.
Right.
You know, she's the one who's sort of up with the times on this. But even that's interesting because she's so fine with that. But even in sort of talking about her own sexual identity, she's a little bit quieter about that. Because like I was saying before, she's from a different time. And though even though she's obviously comfortable with that, was married to a woman and all the kind of stuff, is something that she didn't really talk about with even her closest friends from back in the day, didn't know some of this stuff about her because she had kept it secret.
Yep. So, I mean, we don't have a lot to say at this moment. We might do a full episode on this at some point. We don't know. I mean, we can always have an opportunity to talk about Fonda and Tomlin. Like, they're just brilliant together. But I did want to just draw it to your attention because I think it's one of those films that kind of flew under the radar. So I think it's important to sort of to watch it because it's pretty fantastic.
Yeah, it is a nice, delightful opportunity to watch two legends do what they do best.
And it's only like an hour and 26 minutes, which, you know, if that isn't recommended to you, then I don't know what will. So I think that's about all we have for today.
Mm-hmm.
So... as always, I have to sort of go through the end spiel. I apologize in advance, but not really.
he does it deliberately, folks.
I do it deliberately. So if you want to get in touch with us, please do follow us on Instagram at Queens of the Bees. You can also follow me on Instagram, Thomas West in the number 3. And of course, you can also follow us, or me at least, on Twitter at TJ West in the number 3. I refuse to call it X. Full stop. So please follow me on there. You can also follow my Substack newsletter, Omnivorous, where I do write about gay stuff. I'll probably end up writing about Marla Grayson at some point. So please do follow me there because I do have some, you know, pretty decent writing. I'm not a bad writer, as it turns out.
Pretty darn good, I'd say.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. So, of course, you know, we also really encourage you to rate or review us wherever you listen to your podcast, Apple, Spotify. We do definitely encourage people to listen on Spotify because we can get sponsored by Spotify. So, you know, if you would please rate or review us, recommend us to your friends. We always appreciate connecting with new listeners and we love talking about movies and we're in TV shows. So, you know, if you have the urge to tell us and praise our sing our praises, then please do so. So, for Queens of the Bees, I'm TJ.
And I'm Aaron.
And we will see you next week.